Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Les. 750 plus 50. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, everybody, we're of course in the Chumash of Shmos, and the Chumash of Shmos has three major themes: the Exodus of Egypt, and then the giving of the Torah, and then of course the building of the Mishkan. And I had mentioned to another group that this really parallels the journey that we all have to make with our own lives. That step one is we have to leave the inner Mitzrayim. Remember, Mitzrayim means Egypt, but Mitzrayim is also a term that means limitations, boundaries, constrictions, and every person has their own Mitzrayim. There's a very famous passage from the Baal HaTanya, the Alter Rebbe, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, whose yahrzeit was just a few days ago, in which the passage that is in the Mishnah and that is in the Haggadah, that each person must regard himself as if they were personally taken out of Mitzrayim. Do you remember that sentence? That you don't just remember what God did in the past, but each person must feel as if they themselves were liberated from Mitzrayim. And what does that even mean, since I was not in Mitzrayim? So he says, no, every person has their own Mitzrayim, constrictions, limitations, boundaries, impediments. A person could have a Mitzrayim of arrogance, a Mitzrayim of selfishness, of egotism, of laziness, of depression. These are Mitzrayims. And when God put into the world the spiritual force of Yetzias Mitzrayim, He has given us the capacity to extricate ourselves from the inner enslavers that prevent us and block us from connecting to God. And therefore, the idea of looking at Sefer Shmos, you're not just looking at a history, but you're looking at a spiritual reality that Hashem put into the world. Historical events are real. God forbid, nobody is saying the Exodus is a metaphor. It happened. But historical events themselves are metaphorical, meaning, to say that the Exodus of Egypt is a metaphor would be apikorsis. But to say that the historical event is a metaphor is absolutely true, because it represents the physical representation of a spiritual power that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put into the Bria, to which we can tap into and become liberated. Now, primarily, this spiritual power becomes manifest on Pesach time. But in microcosm, in these very weeks where we read about Yetzias Mitzrayim, it also comes in. That's why these weeks are special weeks, because these are weeks that if we use them properly, we can become liberated from that which enslaves us. Right? That's the Bala Tanya says, is each person must regard himself as if they were liberated from Mitzrayim. And as the saying goes, it is much easier to take the Jew out of Mitzrayim than it is to take Mitzrayim out of the Jew. But leaving Mitzrayim is not enough. If all we do is liberate ourselves, the question is, for what purpose? To be free is not a purpose in life. People say, I live to be free. To be free to do what? Freedom may be a condition to be able to accomplish what you need to do in life, but it is not an end in and of itself. As a result, just as Pesach, which is the holiday of freedom, is inextricably connected to Shavuos, which is the holiday of Matan Torah, because without Torah, freedom is worthless. Freedom is destructive. Chazal make the point in a number of ways. They make the point that the grain offering of Pesach time is a barley grain offering, which was typically animal fodder. And on Shavuos, it was a wheat offering, which is human food. Pesach without Shavuos is animal liberation. It is not human freedom. Human freedom is when freedom is harnessed into a goal that goes beyond yourself. Eric Fromm, happened to be Jewish, but a non-religious disciple of Sigmund Freud, once remarked that we make a big mistake when we describe freedom as freedom from something. Rather, freedom has to be freedom towards something. And that's exactly what Har Sinai is. And that is why Yetzias Mitzrayim is followed after a period of 49 days of preparation with Matan Torah. I may have mentioned this before, but if I haven't, I want to be sure that I do say it to you. There was a very famous Indian poet, Tagore, who remarked, and he was not Jewish, and he probably didn't even know any Jews. He said, a human being, a human soul, is like a violin string. It is capable of expressing beautiful music. But take a string, take it off the violin, put it on the table. The string is totally free. It's liberated. It is not constrained. But it cannot produce any music. All of the beauty within is locked in, inexpressible. How do you get music out of a string? You tie it down. You confine it. You seemingly limit it. But it's in that process of limitation that the beauty that is within gets revealed. Do you see what a mashal that is? The Torah? Because we look at Torah superficially as that which enslaves, that which imprisons, that which limits, that which confines. Even a religious Jew might superficially and of course wrongly look at Judaism. Another person might say, well, I'm a good servant of God, so even though all of this stuff is just crimping my style, I do it. And that's a madrega. I don't want to disparage that. A person is serving God that way. But ultimately, there's something much deeper. That it is precisely the Torah that liberates us in the sense of empowering us to express and to realize the beauty and individuality of our souls. And therefore, Matan Torah is not simply a servitude that is imposed on the freedom. You might look at it that way. In fact, there's a chazal that talked that way sometimes, in which Hashem said, you were slaves of Paro, and now you're my slaves. But another way of looking at it is that it is Matan Torah that is part of the freedom and part of the liberation. It's not something superimposed on the liberation. It is the meaning of the freedom. to enable me to accomplish what I'm capable of accomplishing, to realize and exemplify the beauty and the radiance of the divine soul that is within. And this brings us to the third transition, building a Mishkan. A lot of the book of Shmos, of course, I'm going to ignore right now the detours, such as the sin of the golden calf. Those are kind of the wrong turns, as it were. But if you're looking at the road, the highway, where we're supposed to be going, Yetzias Mitzrayim, Matan Torah, building a Mishkan. The Mishkan is the tabernacle. The Mishkan is the temple. It was a traveling temple. When we get to Eretz Yisrael, you know, we eventually have the real base, the permanent base on Mikdash, on the Temple Mount. But in the desert, we have the traveling Mishkan. Now, what is the Mishkan? So the Pasuk says, when Hashem gave the commandment to build the Mishkan, Hashem said, Asu li Mikdash. Build for me a sanctuary, a sanctified place. Vishachanti bisocham, so I may dwell within them. Now note the language of the verse. The pasuk does not say, build for me a temple, so I will dwell within it. Now God dwells, as it were, within the temple. It says, no, build for me a temple, so I will dwell within them, meaning within you, within the people. Meaning the real place where God lives, whatever that phrase actually means, is in the heart and soul of the Jew that serves Hashem with devotion. This is the temple. The Mishkan, and again, I keep on coming back to metaphorical usage. We build a Mishkan to remind us and to teach us of the potentiality that each and every one of us has, that every single person can become a dwelling place for the divine presence. Right? The Mishkan is a reminder of what we are. There's a very beautiful song, actually it comes from a statement of the Sefer HaRedim, one of the Mekubalim of Tzfatz, Bilvavi Mishkon Evnech. In my heart, I build a dwelling place for Hashem. From his very popular series of very inspirational Svarim, both in Hebrew and English now, written by Rav Schwartz Shlita, where it's called the Bilvavi series, right? But it's based on this word, Bilvavi Mishkon Evnech. I build a tabernacle for God in my heart. And that's a level that even goes beyond Kabbalah Satara. Kabbalah Satara means I submit to God and I obey God's commandments. But then, the hope is we can reach some type of level in which every single action that we do expresses the glory of Hashem. And we become a Beis HaMikdash. We become, as the Mesillas Yesharim says, our eating and our drinking becomes like korbanos to Hashem. Now these are very, very high levels, and this is not something that we will necessarily be able to attain at all, but it's a goal to strive. It's a yearning. You look at what you could become. You know, I remember many, many years ago, there was a great man, he taught in Or Sameach for a while, Rav Simcha Wasserman, Zichrono Livracha. He has a picture. If you go to the office, we ought to label our pictures. We have a whole photographic gallery of great, great rabbis, but you wouldn't know who they are because they're not labeled. There's the Or Sameach himself. That's the oldest picture. Rav Meir Simcha is there. And it's worthwhile to actually look. There is a concept of looking at the face of great righteous people. Although I'm not sure if it applies to photographs necessarily. It does have a certain spiritual benefit to a person. So one of the people there is a Rav Simcha Wasserman. Rav Simcha Wasserman himself was the son of a great, great gadol who died in the Holocaust, Rav Elchanan Wasserman. You may have heard of Rav Elchanan Wasserman. And Rav Elchanan Wasserman in turn was the great disciple of the Chafetz Chaim. And Rav Simcha Wasserman was his son, who survived the Holocaust. And Rav Simcha Wasserman himself was a great, great Talmud Chacham. But it's interesting, they were very different in personality. Rav Elchanan Wasserman was recorded to be an extremely serious person. He almost never smiled. He was very, very serious. And when he would smile on Purim, whatever it is, the Talmidim would record it. The Rebbe smiled today. Rav Simcha Wasserman, interestingly enough, maybe his name was Simcha, was very opposite. He never was without a smile. He was very, very humorous and joking and friendly and warm-hearted in an open way. So someone I knew was not even that religious. It was a young woman who was not so religious, but she had been involved with Rav Simcha Wasserman's teachings. She said when Rav Simcha that what made her so happy about Rav Simcha Wasserman is that she knew that if God forbid, all of the Torah would be forgotten. Let's say nobody remembered how to do mitzvahs. She could just watch Rav Simcha Wasserman for a day and she could reconstruct the whole edifice of Judaism from just watching his behavior. That every single movement that he did was not haphazard. It was serving Hashem the way Hashem wanted us to serve him. So she said if the Torah would be forgotten by everybody, she could reconstruct it from him. Again, it's an amazing thing. Rav Simcha Wasserman taught in many places, but he taught in Or Sameach for a while. It's interesting, just a little story, but it's a powerful story, that he and his Rebbetzin were not zocha to have children. They didn't have any children, although thousands and thousands of people are effectively their children and the future generations as well. So when he died, his Rebbetzin said that she has no reason to want to live without him, but such a man deserves someone that will sit Shiva for him. And she was the only relative that would sit Shiva. So she willed herself to stay alive for 7 days to sit Shiva for him. And then, very, very shortly thereafter, may have been the next day, I don't want to say for sure, she died. She kind of forced herself to stay alive to observe a whole Shiva. And then she left the world. She couldn't bear to be without him, but she was going to give him the honor and the respect of sitting Shiva, be it as it may. But the reason I'm just bringing him in is for this third idea, that there's a certain level that you reach which goes beyond just keeping the Torah, in which every single action is a reflection of the holiness of Hashem. That's building a Mishkan. Leave the Mitzrayims, become free of the passions, the desires, the hedonism, the decadence, the selfishness, the egotism. Get rid of it. That's like chametz. Burn it away. But then, take that freedom. Submit to Hashem. Matan Torah. And the third stage is, every aspect of your life is a reflection of Hashem's glory. Make yourself a mishkan, a dwelling place for the divine. Right? That's the book of Shmos. Yeah, there are going to be false starts, and there are going to be detours, and wrong turns, and mistakes, as the book of Shmos tells us. But ultimately, this is the trajectory, this is the highway, this is the road that one goes on. Now, if you recall, at the end of Parsha Shmos, there seems to be an initial setback. Moshe had argued with God over and over and over again, and the Medrash makes it much more extensive than we even know. The Chumash itself talks about a long argument they had. According to the Medrash, this took a whole week. Moshe is arguing with God for a whole week. God gives Moshe a job. Redeem my people, save my people, you're the man. And Moshe says, I'm not worthy, they're not worthy. You know, he goes in both directions. I don't deserve the job, they don't deserve to be free. I don't have the talent, I am a stutterer, I don't speak well. It's pretty odd. You know, there's almost a contradiction here, because we say Moses declines the offer because of his great humility. I'm not worthy. But a person says to God, you know, on the other hand, you know, if a person is so exceedingly humble, and God says, do my will, and you say back to God, I'm sorry, God, I'm too humble to do your will. In other words, it's almost the opposite. To be able to speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and argue with him, One would not associate that with humility necessarily. And I'm not even going to address that question, but Moshe argues and argues and argues and argues and argues, and finally Hashem says in the beautiful immortal Pasuk, right, who gives the mouth to the man and who gives the ability of any of these things? It is only I, and I will give you that ability, and Aaron will assist you. So it took a whole week for Hashem to convince Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu finally takes the responsibility. He's not a youngster, of course. He's 80 years old. Which, by the way, is a very interesting reminder that you never really know what the purpose of your life is. You know, sometimes people think when they're 22, they know what their life's mission is. Mm-hmm. What did Moshe think his life's mission was when he was 22? Or 32? Or 42? Or 52? Or 62? Or 72? Moshe had a whole life before this even happened, which the Torah almost doesn't recount. He leaves Egypt, marries, and then there's a whole career in Africa. He had a whole he was a king. He had all sorts of careers, which in retrospect wasn't the point. So never give up. You know, you could be even at an advanced stage and discover a purpose in your life that is your purpose. Quite amazing. So Moshe finally goes. He comes to Paro and he says, send the Jewish people out of Egypt. And Paro mockingly and sarcastically says, who is this God that I should listen to him? I never heard of him. I have all my gods. I have all the foreign people that send me gifts and tributes. And your God I have never even heard of. Who do you think you are? Okay, so at a minimum, Moshe fails. But what's even worse is things get worse. What does Paro do? Paro says, these guys have too much free time on their hands. That's why they're agitating for civil rights, for freedom. They're not working hard enough. So when you have idleness, you begin to think about all sorts of crazy fantasies. From now on, they still got to produce their quota of bricks, but they also have to gather the straw that they mix in the mortar for the bricks. We're not going to give it to them anymore. In other words, he made it much worse. So Moshe feels like a total failure. Not only did he not save his people, which God seemed to promise him, but he made it worse. And of course, the people deeply resented Moshe as well, he says. Who do you think you are? Who asked you to go? And Moshe turns in anguish to the Almighty. And he says, Lama hareyosa la'am hazeh. Why did you make it worse for this people? U'me'oz basi al paro l'daber b'shmecha, from the time that I came to Paro to speak in your name, you made it worse. V'atzeh lo'itzaltim. Heirali amazeh, you made it worse. V'atzeh lo'itzaltim, you didn't say. And God tells Moshe, this is actually now the beginning of the new Parsha, that, you know, I made many promises to the Avos that they did not experience their fulfillment. And they did not question me. And why do you question me? So here, I want to speak about the following drash. God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, don't give up hope. There will be a redemption. This is part of the process by which the Jewish people will come out of Egypt. And he uses, this is a very, very famous teaching, he uses four terms of redemption. Lachain emor livnei Yisrael. Tell b'nei Yisrael, ani Hashem, I am Hashem, that's Yud Kei Vav Kei. And here Yud Kei Vav Kei is both the name of divine mercy, and it's also the name of Naaman, l'shalem sechar, which means God is dependable, God is reliable, God will do what he said he will do. Ani Hashem. And what are the four terms of redemption? Hotseisi, I will take them out of Egypt. Vihitzalti, I will save them. Vigo'alti, I will redeem them. V'lokachti eschem li liyam, I will take them for me as a nation. Tell B'nai Yisrael these four, the show notes of Geula. There is actually a fifth expression, I will bring them to the land. But as the Maral explains, we don't count that as redemption. Redemption is taking you out of your servitude. Where he takes you is another level. But the Geula are four Lishonot of Geula. Votseisi, Vitzalti, Vigaalti, Volokachti. Halachically, this listing of the four Lishonos of Geula is extremely important, because according to many sources in Chazal, although it's not the only reason, this is why the Chachamim enacted at the Seder night, we drink four cups of wine to commemorate the four terms of redemption with which God promised to redeem the Jewish people. I'm sure you've heard of this, that the Dalad Kosos of Yayin, or grape juice, whatever you drink, is Keneged, the four Lishonos of Geula. There are other reasons, but this is a reason that is the most commonly accepted reason. Now, the question becomes, what is the significance? Of course, the number four is a very important number in the Seder. We have four sons. We have four cups of wine. We have four questions. Right? Four is a big deal throughout the Seder and the like. But what is the significance of four Lishonos of Geula? I mean, Yetzias Mitzrayim was one event. And if you're going to divide it, then call it 10 events because of the 10 plagues. But why would four be particularly significant? So I want to share with you two Midrashim. And the Midrashim themselves do not directly connect, but I want to show you a thought that does connect them. Midrash number one is that the four Lishonos of Geula, the four terms of redemption, correspond to the four evil decrees that Paro promulgated upon the Jewish people. Paro decreed four different things against us from which we were liberated. What are the four decrees of Paro? So decree number one is slavery, that we are enslaved. Decree number two, which had already been abrogated, decree number two was when he initially told, remember when Paro had someone gave him a prophecy, an astrological prediction, that there would be a child born to the Jewish people that would save his people. So Paro initially commanded the midwives that every Jewish boy that is born, you shall strangle at the moment of birth. And you recall, of course, that the main Jewish midwives were Shifra and Pua. And according to Chazal that Rashi brings, Shifra and Pua were the alternative names of Yocheved and Miriam. They were given the job to murder Jewish boys. And of course, the Torah says, that's Gezerah number two of Paro. The Torah says they did not carry them out. Remember, they had an excuse. Jewish women don't use midwives. As soon as the baby's born, you know, the mother gets up, etc. But whatever it is. But that's Gezerah number two. Gezerah number three was what Paro did when he saw that Shifra and Puo didn't do their job. And that is, he commanded the soldiers to come into the houses and throw the babies, the males at least, into the Nile River. That was Gezerah number three. Okay? And Gezerah number four seems to be the least innocuous, or the least severe, the most innocuous, and that is the Gezerah of Tevin, the Gezerah that after Moshe Rabbeinu came in and asked for freedom, the Jews now have to gather their own straw. So the Medrash says there were a total of four evil decrees that Paro promulgated against the Jewish people. And at different times, God redeemed us from all of those four decrees. From slavery, from the genocide of the Mialdos, of the midwives, from the genocide of the soldiers, and from the Gezerah of Straw. That is Medrash number one that connects the four decrees of Paro to the four Lishonot of Geula. There is Medrash number two. Medrash number two says that in these four Lishonos of Geula, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is merames is hinting that not only will there be a redemption from Egypt, but there will be a redemption from all of the exiles that the Jewish people will suffer until the coming of the Mashiach. Now, you know, we have in our tradition that there are four exiles. This is, Mitzrayim doesn't count as an exile because that was pre-coming to Eretz Israel, meaning as a nation. But the four exiles after we came to Eretz Israel, we have the Babylonian exile, where the Babylonians destroyed the first temple. Then we have the Persian exile, which is where the story of Purim happens. And then Alexander the Great conquered the Persian Empire, and Eretz Israel became occupied by the Grecian Empire. And that's where the story of Hanukkah happens. And then eventually Rome conquered Greece and Eretz Israel. And that initiated the fourth exile, called the Golus of Rome, or it's Golus of Edom, Esav, because we consider Esav to be the ancestor of Rome. And we are still in the Galus of Edom, that the Romans destroyed the second temple in the year 70 of the Common Era. And although the Roman Empire is long gone, we are still considered to be in the Galus of Rome, both because the temple they destroyed has not been rebuilt, and because Western civilization and Christianity generally is connected to Rome, right? The Pope officially is the Bishop of Rome, right? You know, there's the Bishop of Indianapolis and the Bishop of Rome. I mean, they're both bishops, etc. Now, this is a talk for another time that certainly deserves another time, and that is, Chazal identified four exiles, with the Gullus of Rome being the last exile before the coming of Mashiach. However, later sources, Rav Chaim Vital, the Ari's Talmud, based on some Midrashim, actually identify a fifth period of persecution that we will undergo before the coming of Mashiach, that will be the most difficult of all, and that is the Galut of Yishmael. Now, Yishmael is the ancestor of the Arab nations. Now, Yishmael, of course, was not a Muslim, so it's not so much Islam, but it's the Arab, you know, which became Islam and the like, and the Midrashim say that will be the most difficult persecution of all. There will be no mercy, and moreover, it's difficult in ways that are hard to understand, because the concept is that Yishmael has spiritual merits. Edom, Esav, represents pure materialism and decadence. Clearly, hedonistic materialism will be defeated by spirituality. But Yishmael represents a certain spiritual power. Number one, Yishmael had bris milah, had circumcision. Number two, Yishmael has a certain power of prayer. Yishmael, God listens. Which means, although their religious fanaticism is often devoted to evil and violence and destruction, because it represents, albeit a misguided submission to God, there's a certain power that they have that other enemies do not have. And that is why Yishmael cannot be vanquished by physical means, because they are not a physical force. Yishmael can be vanquished only by spiritual means. Our Torah, our tefillah. And if you think about it, that's exactly the case, because the particular threats that we face, whether it's Al-Qaeda, whether it's ISIS, whether it's Palestinian terrorism, are not threats that are amenable to conventional deterrence. Now, if you take the 50 years before the end, from the end of World War II until the fall of the Soviet Union, so although there were regional wars, but there was no world war during that time, and the way peace, in quotation marks obviously, but the way peace was preserved was by a strategy that was called MAD. MAD is an abbreviation, Mutually Assured Destruction. What's the theory of MAD? That we knew that the Soviet Union would not send an atom bomb to the United States, because if they tried that, we would send an atom bomb to them, and they don't want to be destroyed, so they're not going to destroy us. And each side had that cheshbon. I'm safe, because if they try anything on me, I'll do something to them, and they wouldn't want that to happen. That works when you have an enemy that doesn't want to die. But when you have an enemy that glorifies death and sees that as the final apocalyptic redemption, then how are you going to stop him? Deterrence doesn't work. And then, when you have these isolated terrorist incidents in which you're crossing a street and somebody just decides, some Arab just decides not to stop the car, what are you going to do? How many policemen are you going to have that are going to be able to take care of that? The answer is nothing. In other words, I don't want to scare you, God forbid. But the point basically is, we are in a situation where there's virtually nothing politically or militarily that we can really do to make this world safe. And the reason is, Yishmael represents dark spiritual energy. Spiritual energy that comes from the bad side of things. But it is a spiritual energy. And spiritual energy can be vanquished only by spiritual energy. Political and military means are going to be ineffectual. Okay, this deserves a talk of its own, Malchus Yishmael, but I just want to go with the Medrash. Remember, the Medrash is pre-Islamic. So the Medrash did not talk about Malchus Yishmael. The Medrash talked about Babylonia, Persia, Greece, and Rome. And in fact, Rav Chaim Vital explains that Yishmael is not really a fifth gullus at all. It is really the tail end of the gullus of Rome, because at the end of days there will be alliances between secular Western culture and Yishmael's religious fanaticism. And that is why Europe is falling apart, as the countries of Europe throw their gates open to unlimited Islamic immigration, whether it's in France or England or Germany, and those countries are destroying themselves. The United States might be another issue, but may apply there as well. That's the alliance, that Malchus Edom itself forms these alliances with Yishmael in a way that is not only destructive to us, but destructive to them. Okay. So be it as it may, by the way, if you know the song Ma'os Sur, right? We said we had just had Hanukkah recently, less than a month ago. So we sang Ma'os Sur. If you look at Ma'os Sur, you will see that each stanza is devoted to a redemption from the gullus. Only, so there's only one Hanukkah stanza. In other words, the one Hanukkah stanza is about the Greeks, but then there's the Persian, the Babylonian, the Persian, the Greek, and the Edomite exile, as well as the Egyptian exile was there as well. Okay. So we have two different midrashim. One midrash correlates the four cups to the four decrees of Paro, and the other medrash correlates the four cups to the four lashonos of redemption to the four exiles, that God will save us from the future exiles. Now these are seemingly unrelated midrashim, but what's very, very beautiful is the Chidushi Harim, the first Gera Rebbe, actually correlates them, because he makes the following point. The Jews were supposed to be in Mitzrayim 400 years. They had to be taken out 190 years early, after 210 years, because they were so assimilated and so spiritually impure that had they stayed another second, they would have hit the 50th level of impurity and they would have been irredeemable. So God had to take us out early. Well, that's good. But there's a cost to being redeemed too early. The Chidushi Arim said, had we been able to spend the entire 400 years in Mitzrayim, we could have been purified of all of our impurities. And we would have entered the land of Israel with the temple and with the Mashiach. And there never would have been a need for any gullus at all. Why did we continue to sin and get exiled? Because we left Mitzrayim with impurities that we did not yet eradicate. An example would be chemotherapy. If, God forbid, a person has cancer, So he takes chemotherapy. Sometimes you got to stop the chemo because the chemo is killing the patient. You got to stop the chemo. You have to. But if you stop the chemo prematurely, you leave some cancer cells in the body, which, God forbid, become cancerous again. Same thing here. If we, see the compound interest of this, if we could have lasted another 190 years, we would not have needed the thousands of years of galus that we now need to perfect ourselves. But because we couldn't last 190, so there was something within us that eventually required a tikkun, a rectification of thousands and thousands of years, that the Mashiach still has not come. Therefore, the Chiddushei Arim says the following idea. And again, I'm sorry I don't have enough time to fully develop this. This is really what I wanted to say. He wants to say that the four decrees of Paro correspond to the four exiles, meaning had those decrees been allowed to run their course, they would have taken the place of the four exiles. But because everything was truncated, we needed the four exiles. Yeah.
How come Hashem took us out when he did?
When he did?
Yeah, like...
No, that's what I'm saying, because there are only 50, there's only 49 levels of impurity. If you hit level number 50, you can't go out. Now, we had become so impure that we had to be taken out. Hashem had to stop the chemotherapy early. Yeah. So let me just explain very quickly the correlation. The first decree of Paro was slavery. Slavery corresponds to the Babylonian exile, because that's exactly what Babylon did. Babylon was the nation that took a free people and made them slaves. See, the other Gullius didn't do that. We already were enslaved. By the time Persia, Greece, and Rome came around, we were already subjugated. So what was the Gullus that took away our freedom, enslaved us? That was the Babylonian exile. So Gezeirah number one, slavery, corresponds to the Gullus of Babylon. Now, Gezeirah number two, which Baruch Hashem didn't happen, that's when he ordered the midwives to strangle the babies. That was attempted genocide. That corresponds to the Persian exile. Because what was the most outstanding, infamous event of the Persian exile? It was Haman's desire to eradicate the Jewish nation. That too was an unsuccessful plan. So the second Gezeirah corresponds to Haman, Persia. Now, the third Gezeirah is harder to match. The third Gezeirah was drown the babies, the males, in the water, which seems to be another form of genocide, and we connect that to Greece. Now here the connection is less obvious. But the Chiddushei Arim says we understand it in a metaphorical way. Water is a symbol for Torah, but water is also a symbol for wisdom generally. What was our challenge in the Greek exile? Remember, the Greeks were perfectly willing to give us political freedom and economic rights. The Greeks were not anti-Semitic. The Greeks were not Hitler, and the Greeks were not Haman. What the Greeks wanted was, what Antiochus wanted was, as crazy as he wanted assimilation, acculturation, he wanted the values of Greek philosophy and literature and science to be the most important parts of our lives. And if Jews would have gone along with the plan, they would have been full citizens with all rights. Many Jews, maybe most of the Jews, went along with it. The Hashmonaim, the Maccabees, were the Haredim of the day. They were the religious fanatics who refused to compromise. But you have to know, many of them were despised not only by the Greeks, they were despised by even many Jews. So, if you look at it this way, to absorb foreign philosophies and make them dominant is like sticking your head in the water. In other words, water itself can be very, very beneficial. You need it for life. But if you take it in the wrong way, such as breathing it into your lungs, you die. So the Chiddush Erim says, this is a bit of a homiletical idea, that drowning in the water, meaning taking the wisdom of the nations, which could be a good thing if you take it a certain way, but when you take it in a way that it replaces the oxygen of Torah, you die. And therefore the drowning in the water is a remez to the galus of Greece. And then we get to the final decree of Pyrrha, gathering straw. How does that correspond to the galus of Edom? That's again a hard one. But the Chiddush Erim says that the nature of gathering straw required people to separate. If all we're doing is making bricks and we get our straw, I can remain with you. You're doing your bricks, I'm doing my bricks. But if each of us has to find our own straw, we have to scatter far and wide. There is now competition as well, because whatever you find, less is available for me to find. So this is called the galus of pizur, of scattering. And in many, many ways, a fundamental characteristic of the galut of Esav, of Edom, is scattering. This is in many ways this is so. In the most literal way it's so, because geographically, Jews are scattered much further than they ever have been. Meaning, in the diasporas of Babylonia, Persia, Greece, Jews were confined still. Even if they weren't in Israel, they were confined to a relatively few countries along the Mediterranean coast. In this galut, we're all over the world, including Antarctica and the North Pole. Families are broken up, families are dispersed. But it's not just geographical dispersion. It is emotional distancing. Remember, the characteristic of the exile of Edom is hatred and polarization among Jews. Sinas chinam. That is the scattering. We're scattered from each other. We're separated from each other. Lack of marriage, marital harmony. The divorce rate skyrockets. The animosities between parents and children. All of this is a sinas chinam that permeates from the koach of the galus of Edom. And finally, there is a scattering not just between one Jew and another Jew, but a scattering within ourselves. We are confused. We are buffeted with so many inputs. It's like the internet. So many different things that come across our mind. So many enticements. So many desires. That we literally get paralyzed with the inability to prioritize and determine what is right and what is wrong. This is called Pizur Hadas. A scattering of the mind. Geographically we're separated. Emotionally we're separated. And our very minds and hearts are scatterbrained with an inability to focus. So what the Chiddush Erim is saying very nicely is that the four decrees of Pyrrha actually correspond to the four exiles. Because had those decrees been able to be carried out for the entire 400 years, there would not have been a need for the four exiles. But because those decrees were truncated, because we were on the 50th, we were approaching the 50th level of Tumah, it was necessary to be carried out in the four exiles. Right? That's the Chiddush Erim connecting these two midrashim. But be it as it may, as I say, our immediate challenge, though we also are confronting the galus of Yishmael, again, this deserves a whole other talk. And in this last galus, we can only vanquish Yishmael with the Spirit. And indeed, let me point out that one of the most famous psukim about the coming of our Redeemer, the Mashiach, is he will be a poor man riding on a donkey, ani, rochev alachamor. If you recall, Yashka tried to use that verse to establish his own credentials. But that was a theatrical thing. He just followed the plot, followed the... But you have to know that the nation of Yishmael is called a chamor, it's called a donkey. That is the term that is used. Therefore, what is the Pasuk telling us? Moshiach will ride on the back of the donkey of Yishmael, that Yishmael will indeed be vanquished and the Geula will come. And we have other good news that it says, and when that Geula comes, Yishmael themselves will do tshuva. Because you know, Yishmael, Avram's son, did do tshuva before Avram died. B'yacharit hayamim, although it seems so implausible, Yishmael too shall do tshuva and become a source that will bless and acknowledge the Jewish people. May it to be Hashem's will that this should happen. B'mehera v'yameinu.